In only 2 days, you can move your career further, faster with a Harvard DCE Professional and Executive Development Program. Advance your leadership skills, craft smarter business strategies, build your network, and move your career in the right direction. You'll earn a certificate of completion, add Harvard to your CV, and become the leader you want to be. Our intensive programs are designed to fit into your busy schedule. Attend online or on the Harvard campus. Search Harvard Professional and Executive Development to learn more.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody. And welcome back to New Books in Science, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Galina Limorenko, doctoral candidate in neuroscience with a focus on biochemistry and molecular biology of neurodegenerative diseases at the BFL in Switzerland, the host of the channel. Today we'll be talking to Jack Price, the author of The Future of Brain Repair, a realist's guide to stem cell therapy. A scientist assesses the potential of stem cell therapies for treating such brain disorders as stroke, Alzheimer's disease, and Parkinson's disease. Stem cell therapies are the subject of enormous hype, endowed by the media with almost magical qualities, and imagined by the public to bring about miracle cures. Stem cells have the potential to generate new cells of different types, and have been shown to do so in certain cases. Could stem cell transplants repair the damaged brain? In this book, neurobiologist Jack Price assesses the potential of stem cell therapies to treat such brain disorders as stroke, Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease, spinal cord injuries. Certainly, brain disorders are in need of effective treatments. These disorders don't just kill. They disable, and conventional drug therapies have not had much success in treating them. Price explains that repairing the human brain is difficult, largely because of its structural, functional, and developmental complexity. He examines the self-repairing capacity of blood and gut cells and the lack of such capacity in the brain, describes the limitations of early brain stem cell therapies for neurodegenerative disorders, and discusses current clinical trials that may lead to the first licensed stem cell therapies for stroke, Parkinson's, and macular degeneration. And he describes the real promise of pluripotential stem cells, which can make all the cell types and that constitute the body. New technologies, Price reports, challenge the very notion of cell transplantation, instead seeking to convince the brain itself to manufacture the new cells it needs. Could this be true future of brain repair? Okay, so it's my pleasure to welcome Jack Price today on our show. And welcome, Jack.
Yeah, well, thank you for the invitation. It's good to join you.
Yeah, pleasure to have you. All right, so we're going to start by asking you, how has the pandemic influenced you and your work? Because as we're living through these unprecedented times.
Well, obviously, research work has become incredibly difficult. So my colleagues at the Institute of Psychology and Neuroscience, which is where I work. Our lab has been shut down a lot of the time, or at least our occupancy has been reduced, so only maybe a half or a third the number of scientists could go in as normal. So that's been a real pain. But there's been a real plus side to it, I have to say. I mean, it's slightly odd the way these things work out sometimes. And I really discovered that a lot of neuroscience seminars are now posted online. So whereas institutes used to organize their own seminars and lectures and keep them to themselves, they now share. And it's terrific. You can sort of dial into seminars all over the world. I've listened over the last few months to lectures in Japan, in Switzerland, where you are, and in the United States, absolutely all over. So that's been an unexpected plus. So there is a plus side, I suppose, to this otherwise pretty miserable situation.
That's a great point. And also communication with the scientists that you would not speak to, isn't it?
That's absolutely right. I think it's also encouraged some of those of us who teach, obviously I'm a university teacher, to think more creatively about our lectures. So, you know, the old-fashioned 1 hour stand up in front of the audience and talk obviously hasn't been working lately. So we've had to think more creatively, and that's also been a positive.
Can you give any examples of how you adapted your lectures?
Well, I mean, for example, we've been told by educationalists for years that after about 8 or 10 minutes of a sort of continuous talk by a lecturer, the students are already losing concentration. So you know, breaking a lecture up into bite-sized pieces and sort of interspersing those pieces with sort of questions and now tell me about this, think about this, you know, just breaking up the monotony of listening to somebody just talk for an hour, that's been a real plus, I think.
Perhaps interspersed with a TikTok dance.
Yeah, that's right, something like that, yeah. Quite a few lecturers now add music, so that, you know, they put a little pause of music in and ask the students to think or do something while the music plays. I have to say I haven't done that because I'm not sure the students that I teach would appreciate my choice of music. But that's
I'm sure your lectures are engaging enough to keep them focused.
Well, I like to think so, you know.
Excellent. All right. So can you tell us more about yourself, your background?
Yes. I'm a developmental neurobiologist by training. So I trained first at the Open University here in the United Kingdom and then at University College, where I worked with Professors Anne Mudge and Martin Raft, two outstanding neuroscientists. So I was very lucky to work in that team. I suppose I then did postdoctoral training at MIT in Boston in the United States, and then returned to the UK after that. I mean, I've had a succession of positions since then. I mean, I've been a professor, as I've said, at King's College, at the Institute of Psychiatry, Psychology and Neuroscience for a good many years now. But I suppose that the tasks I've undertaken, the jobs I've done that are most relevant to what we're going to talk about today, are the roles that I've had. So I've been very lucky in my career. I've had roles around sort of stem cell science, neuroscience repair, that kind of thing, in academic, in commercial, and also in sort of regulatory settings. So as I've said, I've been a professor at King's for quite a few years. That's a sort of an academic setting. And while I was in that setting, I helped design and create the cells that went into what turned out to be the first stem cell therapy clinical trial for a neurological, for a brain disorder in Europe. So that was the PiSEES trial. I also, for a few years, was director of molecular neuroscience at Smith Kline Beecham, which, as you know, it's now part of GlaxoSmithKline, but it was a major pharmaceutical company based here in the UK. And for 3 years, I was head of the Division of Advanced Therapies at the National Institute for Biological Standards of Control, which is part of the MHRA, so the medicines regulator here in the United Kingdom. So I very much saw medicine's development and therapeutics from a sort of regulatory perspective. And while I was doing that job, I was also director of the United Kingdom Stem Cell Bank. So you may be aware that the UK, I think uniquely in the world, has a stem cell bank, which was authorised by Parliament. So it's actually set up by the UK government, and I was director of that for several years. So I suppose I like to think that I've sort of seen stem cell science, I've seen stem cell therapeutics, cellular therapeutics, and advanced therapies generally from a number of different perspectives. So that's me, I suppose.
So, yeah, it looks like you tried your hand in industry, in academia, in regulatory disciplines. So can you tell us, why did you choose academia? Was that your initial sort of aspiration?
That was my sort of first love, and I've spent far more years in academia than in any other environment. I mean, it's research, isn't it? I mean, you know, you're in research, you know exactly what I mean. There's nothing quite like the feeling of discovering something for the first time, you know, looking down a microscope and seeing something and realizing you're the first person to really see that. So nothing can substitute for that, I suspect. So academia is sort of my first love, and that's where I've spent most of my time.
Yeah, for sure. Nothing compares to that feeling. But as we know, there are a lot of tribulations and sort of trial and errors in academia. So do you have any advice for our young early career young researchers?
I don't know. I mean, it's very difficult to give generic advice. I mean, I've been a mentor in the academic environment, and, you know, giving advice to junior people coming through is very, very important. I'm slightly leery about giving generic advice because, to be perfectly honest, that certain people are clearly going to do well in academic neuroscience and just need to be encouraged to keep going. Others have to be encouraged to look for something else. I feel quite a few scientists keep going in an academic environment when it really is clear it's not for them. You'll be aware that the sort of pyramid in academic promotion with academia is a very sort of sharp pyramid. There are jobs in sort of senior academic posts probably for less than 10% of the people who come through with PhDs. And there are lots of other great jobs out there. Like I say, I've worked in a regulatory setting, in commercial settings. There's some very rewarding and very interesting careers out there. I think it's important to, if you're really sure you want to be an academic, sure, you've got to go for it and work hard at it, and hopefully it'll come right. But it's important not to be blinded by other opportunities that might come your way.
That's great advice, and really appreciate your honesty. Okay, so just before we start, so you are a developmental neurobiologist.
Yeah.
Can we, if from the beginning, just define how different is developmental neurobiologist from neurodegenerative disease biologist? Because these two sound very similar, but at times you have to make that distinction.
Yes. Well, I suppose you could argue that they're at opposite ends of the neuroscience spectrum in terms of time. I mean, mm-hmm. developmental neurobiology obviously tends to concentrate on how the nervous system develops, starting, you know, in the embryo and through the fetus and into early life. Whereas neurodegeneration, I mean, not exclusively, of course, there are neurodegenerative disorders that start in childhood, Batten's disease and others like it. But neurodegeneration mostly, I suppose, would be considered to be that set of diseases suffered by the elderly. So, you know, Parkinson's disease, Alzheimer's disease, disorders of that kind. So the pathology of those disorders is really quite distinct in lots of different ways from the processes that govern development. That said, molecular and cellular mechanisms tend to be common right across or biological processes. So quite often we find ourselves studying the same processes, albeit with a different sort of bias. I'm trying to think of a very specific example, but you told me earlier that you're working on tau. Well, tau is obviously pivotal in Alzheimer's disease, at least that's what we think. But tau is a really significant protein in the development of axonal connections. So, you know, one of the major proteins involved in extending an axon for a baby neuron is the tau gene, tau protein. So quite often we end up studying the same things in a different context, I suppose.
Yes, exactly. And tau is also involved in cell division, which is...
Indeed. Yeah, and nothing's more important than cell division during development, of course. Yeah.
So now, as we jump in to discuss your book, which is The Future of Brain Repair, so does it actually starts to bring these two ends of the spectrum slightly together, doesn't it?
Well, they do. And actually, it's if I might be permitted a little anecdote, that the reason why I got into this area of research was because there was a developmental explanation for how stem cells might work in bringing about brain repair. And frankly, as a developmental biologist, I just didn't believe it. So the idea was that if you put stem cells and transplanted them into a damaged brain where nerve cells had been lost through disease or through injury, the idea was that the stem cells would replace the lost nerve cells. That was the original hypothesis. But as somebody who'd been studying the development of nerve cells and had some understanding of the mechanisms that drove fate determination during brain development, in other words, drove developing cells to take on different neuronal identities, I just couldn't imagine that engrafted stem cells would have the information they needed to make the correct decisions to replace missing cells. And so I got into this because, as I say, I didn't believe it. And then an old colleague of mine, a chap by the name of Jeffrey Gray, now sadly deceased, who was professor of psychology at the Institute of Psychiatry, when he and I met up and I said, I don't believe it could possibly work, he said, oh, well, you're wrong, because I've shown it does. And then he described to me a series of experiments in which he'd shown categorically that if you injected stem cells into the brain of an experimental animal that had suffered brain damage, then sure enough, the animal got better. So functionally, it showed recovery. And it was the fact that I couldn't imagine how that could possibly happen that sort of got me into this area of research.
Was there a specific brain region that these were injected into?
Yes. Well, he started working on the hippocampus. And as you know from somebody studying neurodegeneration, the hippocampus has been the focus of a lot of attention from neuroscientists. The development of the hippocampus is interesting, but the role it plays in, for example, memory formation, in the control of affect, so the control of emotions, And in neurodegeneration, because it's a pivotal site of cell loss, particularly in the development of Alzheimer's disease, and as I said, has attracted a lot of attention in that regard. So what Jeffrey and his colleagues showed, and I'm obviously going back a long time now, this is sort of 20 years ago, was that if you injected stem cells into an animal that had a damaged hippocampus, then sure enough, they recovered. And you could show that by showing that the memory loss that they otherwise had sort of improved following the engraftment of stem cells. So, yes.
Was this engraftment without any other cofactors or some signaling molecules?
It was. Yeah, absolutely it was. And we thought at the time, and we had some evidence that it was indeed because of cell replacement. that the stem cells were turning into the hippocampal neurons that had been lost because of the injury. But we subsequently discovered that it was something else was going on. And that led us and several others working in the same field at the same time to identify what we now tend to call the bystander effect. And that was this very strange phenomenon that we still don't really understand, by which when you engraft stem cells into a damaged brain, they seem to do something other than cell replacement. They seem able to encourage the damaged brain to repair itself. And several things happen following the engraftment of these cells. The brain starts to build new vasculature. It encourages its own immune system to get more involved in the brain repair, and that has positive effects. It encourages plasticity amongst the host stem cells, so that the brain's own stem cells become activated and make more neurons. Quite a few things happen, and it turns out that thinking about stem cells just in terms of what they could give rise to, so in other words, thinking about them in terms of the other types of cells they could produce, was missing something very, very important about stem cells, namely that they're actually just very sensitive cells. The cells are very sensitive to their environment, and they respond to their environment. And where they sort of sense damage, where they sense cell loss, they do a number of things to bring about sort of functional improvement. And that's been one of the great discoveries, I think, from not only our work, of course, lots of labs have discovered this. And it's been one of the really pivotal findings that emerged from stem cell research in the last couple of decades.
So how do these brain stem cells differ from other types of stem cells in a body?
Well, that's a very good question. And to be honest, we're not entirely clear still about that. The trivial answer is that they make brain cells, whereas other types of stem cells make other types of cells. So, for example, you'll be aware that in your bone marrow, you have a population of stem cells that make blood cells. And you're absolutely dependent on that population of bone marrow cells to keep you replenished with red cells and lymphocytes and macrophages and all the other white blood cells that make up normal blood complement. That's the difference between those cells. But more importantly, of course, is what's the molecular difference between different types of stem cells that make them attuned to the different settings they lie in. We don't really know the full answer to that, although in the end, of course, it's the genes that those different stem cell types express and the behaviors those genes push the cells towards. But it also depends on something we're now very interested in stem cell science, what we call the stem cell niche. So the niche, the site where the stem cells live, where they find themselves, is really important, and the cells interact with the other factors in that niche. So the other cells and the extracellular matrix and so on and so forth that make up the niche. And it's together with the niche that they find themselves in that the cells adopt the behaviors they adopt. So it's a very elegant piece of biology, the stem cell niche and how it behaves.
So does this niche environment have to be healthy for stem cells to develop correctly?
Well, that's certainly true. I mean, as you would imagine, like all biology, it's easily disrupted and things can go wrong. And if it's not working properly, that's the case. But of course, in a sense, it really comes into its own when things aren't quite optimal. So, you know, in the bone marrow niche, for example, which, as I say, we now understand pretty well, people have sort of hematologists and immunologists have been working on it for many, many years. And one of the things we now realize is that it's very sensitive to things going wrong. So, you know, if you have a bleed and you lose blood, the stem cell niche quickly senses that and turns on the production of more blood cells to replace the ones you've lost. So therefore, you can, you know, rest easy going and donating a pint of or a half a litre of blood every whatever 3 or 6 months if you're a blood donor, confident that your bone marrow will respond and replace it very, very quickly. So that they're very much sensitive to things not being quite as they should be and react accordingly.
Okay, so let's take perhaps maybe a more specific example. So yeah. Say we have a neurodegeneration in hippocampus due to AD, so in a person.
Yeah.
So the suggestion would be to take stem cells from outside and inject them into this area, right?
Yep. And people are doing that. So in experimental animals, there is some evidence that that approach works. Whether it'll be viable in patients, I don't think is entirely clear yet. I think it's fair to say that Alzheimer's disease is one of the less well-developed stem cell therapeutic approaches at this time. There are other diseases where approaches have developed much further, which isn't to say that Alzheimer's won't eventually be amenable to this kind of treatment, but currently it's not quite there. I think the problem generally with Alzheimer's is, or rather, the two problems that are generally the case. The one is that it's a very widely effective neurodegeneration, if that isn't a strange way of putting it. In other words, brain cells are lost more or less all over the brain. So you mentioned the hippocampus, and that's one of the sites where it seems to get started. But eventually, and quite quickly, within a few years, the brain cells are lost really all over the cerebral cortex and elsewhere. So that makes it a challenge. It's almost certainly not going to be sufficient to replace brain cells in just one region. Somehow you'd have to induce, you know, the entire brain to replace itself, and that's an enormous challenge. And then the other problem, and there are several neurodegenerative disorders where this is the case. The second problem is that by the time the disease is really noticeable, by the time there's a clear clinical evidence of onset of dementia, the disease has already progressed really quite a long way. This is a similar problem in Parkinson's disease. It's been estimated that the vast majority of the dopaminergic neurons, which seem to be really pivotal in Parkinson's disease, by the time the person presents with symptoms, probably the majority of those dopaminergic neurons have already been lost. So you can imagine that really makes it really quite a challenge.
Yes, but there is also a trial going on in Japan at the moment in injecting the iPSC, derived neurons.
Yes.
So really interested to see how that turns up.
Yes, absolutely. No, absolutely. There are, as I've said, there is data in experimental animals, and that's led, as you've said, to clinical trials. And iPS cells, all our audience might not know what they are, but these supremely flexible stem cells are really the source of choice now for starting a therapeutic approach like this. And absolutely, Alzheimer's disease is certainly going to be a potential target.
So do these injected stem cells have potential to turn into all sorts of neuronal cell types, like the oligodendrocytes or neurons are predominant type?
Well, before I answer that, let me try and make an important distinction. So in some therapeutic approaches, it's actually the stem cells themselves that are injected. The trial that I've been involved in over a number of years for stroke, that was the case. But we just mentioned iPS cells, which is, as you know, is one type of pluripotent cell. When a therapeutic is being derived using those cells, it's not the stem cells themselves that are injected in the brain. That wouldn't be safe for a variety of reasons we can perhaps talk about. But rather, the cells are turned into brain cells first. And it's the brain cells, the sort of fairly immature brain cells that are injected rather than the stem cells. So in a number of disorders now, these iPS cells or embryonic stem cells, which is another variety of pluripotent cells, are differentiated into a particular type of brain cell type, the type that seems to be most important in that particular disease. And it's those brain cell types that are injected into the brain. So probably the best examples of that, the two most advanced examples of that currently would be Parkinson's disease, and then a disease of the eye, so macular degeneration, age-related macular degeneration. So in Parkinson's disease, it's the loss of the dopaminergic neurons, as I've already mentioned, that project to the forebrain. It's the loss of those cells that really has the really big impact on mobility, on the ability of a patient to initiate movement. And in the case of the macular degeneration, it's the photoreceptors, the loss of photoreceptors, that's most pivotal. And there, what's injected is a cell type called the pigment epithelium. For reasons that we can perhaps go into, they play a support role, and it turns out they're the most important cell type there. So in each case, then the iPS cells are being used to make the therapeutically most appropriate cell type, and it's that that's injected into the brain.
So as you mentioned, the macular degeneration research is really getting advanced now, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. It's the most exciting. Mm. Well, as I say, that and Parkinson's disease are probably the most advanced at this present time. Very exciting developments in that field. Yeah.
Are there other systemic circuitry, so peripheral nervous system diseases that can be also targeted using stem cells?
There are. So, again, there's a number of different disorders that are being addressed. One of the things that's been looked at is axial peripheral nerve injury. So it's been known for quite a long while that if you can provide an appropriate substrate, then nerve cells will regrow their connections. So where there's been an injury, for example, in a peripheral nerve or in a projection from the spinal cord, if you can put an appropriate pathway for the newly growing axons to grow along, then there's evidence that you can reconnect those nerve fibers. And stem cells or stem cell derivatives are thought to possibly play a role in that. So there are a number of investigators now looking at that. One of the more intriguing avenues that are being considered now is a disorder called Hirschsprung's disease. And that's this horrible congenital situation where children are born essentially without an enteric nervous system. So the enteric nervous system is the intrinsic nerve cells that occupy the gut. And gut motility and a lot of activity in the gut is controlled by these enteric neurons that surround the gut wall. And these children who are born with this Hirschsprung's disease simply don't have any of those nerve cells. So some investigators now are starting to try and think if they could replace those, and that would make an enormous impact on the lives of those children. So that's an area to keep an eye on.
Really interesting. A lot of developments.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
So with regards to central nervous system stem cell therapy, does it have to be combined with activity-based repair? So, for example, the brain circuits that are being used more, do they need to be used more to get repaired?
That's a good question. There's no definitive answer to that yet. In experimental animals, there is evidence that that's the case. We don't know in patients, but I have to say I'd be very surprised if that wasn't true. because we know that encouraging patients, say following a stroke, for example, would probably be the best example. Encouraging patients in the use of the limb or whatever it is that the stroke's really affected, can bring about recovery, can aid recovery. And I'd be very surprised if there wasn't a synergy between that and a cell therapy approach. But as far as I know, there's no evidence for that in patients at the present time. Mm. There's a lot of anecdotal stuff around patients. I mean, one of the big problems, maybe we want to talk about this, is that at the present moment, there are no actual licensed therapies for neurodegenerative or, in fact, any CNS disorder. But that doesn't mean that patients aren't being injected with cells, because there are a number of clinics and practitioners out there who, in a fairly unprincipled kind of way, and in my opinion, highly unethical way, injecting patients with cells. And this is a worldwide problem, really, because a lot of patients are being encouraged to try these unlicensed therapies and don't realize that they're putting themselves in considerable danger in doing so.
That's right. It's really worrying. It has the whole field has so much potential, but it needs to be regulated.
Absolutely. Yes. Absolutely. And I mean, I think, you know, you and I are both in Europe. I think regulators here have by and large done a pretty good job of managing to restrict that kind of activity. In other countries, though, I suppose most notably the US, where a sort of direct-to-consumer healthcare is much more prominent, and where patients quite often would look on the internet and find a clinic offering something and go directly to those clinics and get sold for tens of thousands of dollars, get sold a cellular therapy without necessarily realizing that it isn't a licensed therapy. That's much more of a problem. And I know the Food and Drug Administration in the United States is desperately trying to bear down on these sort of cowboy organizations, but only with a certain degree of success at this stage.
Yeah, so perhaps we can discuss the risks involved in these therapies. So what would be the major ones you could
I think at this stage, with any new therapy, the two risks are: one is there's no efficacy, in other words, they don't work, and the second is that they're not safe. Regulators, needless to say, are particularly keen on safety. That they want to be absolutely sure that there's no risks to the patients. And with cell therapies, there are obvious risks straight off. I mean, one of the things that's been recognized in stem cell science for a long time is that if you take a stem cell from where it would normally reside, and we talked, didn't we, a moment ago about the stem cell niche. If you take a cell from its stem cell niche and put it somewhere else, then its behavior is going to change. And these are cells that have the potential to expand and generate other cells. And so that the chance of them forming some kind of a tumor is really quite serious. Now, I think we can be fairly sure that before any therapy gets a license and becomes a properly available therapy, that potential will have been looked at very, very carefully. But amongst the unlicensed therapies, there's been several examples where people have had stem cells injected into their spinal cord, for example, and subsequently come away with a growth on their spinal cord, which has been very, very serious. So there are certainly examples of that. One of the problems is that stem cells, or in fact just cellular therapies, so whatever the source of the cells, are very, very difficult to produce consistently. So if you compare them to sort of more traditional medicines, they are relatively easy to produce in a reproducible and secure fashion. Now, I say relatively easy. They're only easy because drug companies have been doing it for decades and they know exactly what they're doing. But once a compound has been shown to be active, then companies quite quickly work out how to generate tablets or medicines reproducibly, all of which are the same and all of which have, you can be sure, you know, each packet of drugs is the same as the previous one. In cell therapies, that's a challenge for the obvious reason that these are living cells and they change. So one of the things that we've discovered in recent years is that as you grow cells in culture and as you manufacture them, they start to accumulate mutations. So cells, just as we're all aware, cells mutate just as they grow. It's just a risk that's intrinsic to cell division. So as cells grow, some of them will actually acquire mutations. And of course, this is one of the causes, probably the major cause of cancer. So a cancer, when it occurs in any patient, is the result of cells having divided and having accumulated mutations, and those having led to this tumorous growth. So one of the big problems facing cell manufacture for cell therapy currently is how to expand cells. So obviously you need millions, billions of cells if you're going to treat a large population of patients. How to achieve that without ending up with cells that are mutated and are tumorigenic. So the manufacturers who are currently working on this are putting a lot of effort in trying to resolve that particular problem.
So I'm really glad that you brought this point up, that homogeneous cell cultures are really hard to produce. It's hard to verify using markers that you've got the homogeneous cultures. So I really appreciate it also in the book that you stay quite realistic about where we are technology-wise. Yeah. So what do you think we need to do to improve our tools and verification to be able to produce such a huge amount of cells that can be useful?
I don't think there's one big thing. I think there are a number of different things that could be done. And you know, people who work on these kind of biological medicines, because I mean, some of the problems that we're suffering with cell therapies, people who've produced vaccines, people who've produced antibody therapies have had to face these kind of problems in the past. So some of them aren't entirely new. And my inclination is, rather than being, you know, a big thing that has to be put right, it's 1,001 little things, little improvements, working out how to detect when mutations have arisen in your culture, working out how to get the culture conditions absolutely optimum such that the mutations aren't encouraged, at least. So, you know, a lot of relatively small additional technologies that will just improve your ability to produce a consistent product. That seems to be the real thing. But, you know, there are, as we're both aware, biology moves forward and currently moves forward, molecular biology, at an absolutely incredible pace. The new technologies that emerge are just stunning. One of the things that's really impacted enormously is what we call single-cell transcriptomics. You know, the ability to look at individual cells, so just a single cell, and assess precisely what genes it's expressing and how it's behaving as a consequence. And that technology, I think, is going to get applied increasingly to cell therapies in a way of identifying asking the question, how many different cell types have I got in this culture? And is that population changing with time? And which are the cell types I really want in there? And which are the cell types I really don't want in there that I really have to clear out of the culture? So I think that's a really exciting development. And, you know, molecular biology is coming up with that and many more. And I'm sure there's exciting things down the track. Perhaps I should say, Galina, that where we currently are, I would say that there are sort of two types of major types of therapies coming through. I've already mentioned that the unlicensed therapies, which I'm keen to see the back of, in the book I talk about them as feral therapies. That's the way I think about them. They're sort of, you know, wild things on the edge of on the edge of science that we really need to try and get rid of. But amongst the therapies that are currently going through clinical trials, so legitimate therapies that are seeking a regulatory approval, there are sort of two major groups, and we've sort of alluded to them a little bit already, but just to spell it out, there are ones that I think of as being sort of legacy therapies. So you'll be aware, and all our listeners will be aware, that developing a successful medicine is a very long process. So there are therapies going through clinical trials now that started on clinical trials, and which the original discoveries for those clinical trials go back 10, sometimes 20 years. I mean, the cells that I was responsible for generating that went into clinical trial, we first developed, I think, about 2005. They first went into patients in 2011. Right, but we're still in clinical trial with those cells. So those are what I kind of think of as sort of legacy technologies, because they're technologies that we derived towards the end of the last century and the early years of this century. So, you know, that they are not now the leading technologies, but because of simply the length of time it takes, those are the technologies that are still working their way through the regulatory process. And we hope we'll get, license approval in the next few years. So the first stem cell therapies for brain disorders to get licensed will probably come from those legacy technologies. But on their heels are the sort of what we could perhaps call the leading edge technologies, and they're some of the things we've been talking about. So we talked a little bit about Parkinson's disease, didn't we, and about macular degeneration. And they're using these pluripotent cells, which are cells that we've really only had in the laboratory for the last decade or two, and only really in the last few years have we learned how to make products from them that are potentially of use in a therapeutic setting. And so those cell therapies are at a much earlier stage. So the ones in Parkinson's disease, in macular degeneration, are really only in phase one or phase one, two trials. So at a much earlier stage. So they've still got some years to go. So they're more promising in the sense that the technology underpinning them is much more elegant and much more, probably more secure. But they're a little bit further back. So we're looking at this whole different scope of cell therapies working their way through. And then, of course, on top of that, there are sort of really state-of-the-art therapies where the technology has really only emerged in the last year or two, and they're still in preclinical study for the most part. But other technologies also starting to find their way into the very early stage clinical trials.
Yes, great point. The complexity should never be underestimated with anything coming through with the cell, starting even from the single cell cultures like HEK293, which have tetraploid and a half genomes.
Yeah,
there's also transcriptomic technologies.
And
will come really handy.
Yes.
So let's think a little bit more than towards the future about the ideal world. So say in about 50 years, I notice that my memory is starting to get really, really bad. And I go to the clinic and they say that part of my hippocampus started degenerating. So how, in this scenario, do you see this stem cell therapies being applied?
Well, the only honest answer is I don't know. let me alter you, offer you two alternatives. So when you reach my age and your memory starts to fade, my guess is that stem cell therapy actually by that stage might have been superseded by a couple of other possibilities. So let me offer you two that might have happened by then that you can look forward to. One of them is what we might call, what's typically called direct reprogramming. So we haven't talked in detail about, we've mentioned iPS cells, but we haven't really talked in detail about how they're generated. And obviously, I don't want to dive too deeply into the molecular biology of that. But what happens in iPS cells is that regular, ordinary somatic cells, like, for example, skin cells or blood cells, are what we call reprogrammed. They're turned into stem cells. And we know how to do that by transiently expressing stem cell genes in these somatic cells, in these fibroblasts or these skin cells, whatever. And we can turn them into stem cells. And that's a really dramatic piece of technology that was originally discovered by Shinya Yamanaka in 2006, a great breakthrough in science. So that's making the iPS cells that, as we've just discussed, are now going into cell therapies. But it's given rise to another line of endeavor, and that's this thing we call direct reprogramming. And the idea then is, instead of taking, say, a skin cell and reprogramming it to make a stem cell, what you can do is take a skin cell, but reprogram it directly to make a nerve cell. Okay, so skip the stem cell step, go straight from one cell type directly into another. And remarkably, that works. And that's now being done in lots of laboratories worldwide. It's become a sort of standard technology. But here's the thing, there's no reason, given the way the technology works, there's no a priori reason why you couldn't do that directly in a person's brain. So the idea would then be that instead of injecting stem cells into your hippocampus because your memory's failing, what could be done, theoretically, would be inject the vector carrying the reprogramming factors into your hippocampus. And we know from experiments from people like Magdalena Goertz in Munich and various other researchers that if you do that, if you get the conditions right, it's not a trivial experiment, but if you do that, you can actually get non-brain cells, or at least non-neuronal cells in the brain, to turn into nerve cells, to turn into neurons that actually will then genuinely replace the nerve cells that you've lost. So in other words, you could do the whole thing inside your own brain without actually introducing any new cells, any foreign cells at all. So this is very exciting technology, and people are working now on working out precisely how you make the cells that you generate turn into exactly the right cell type, because obviously any old cell won't do. You have to make the cells turn into exactly the right cell type, the cell type you're looking to replace. And that technology is really developing really fast. So one alternative, I suspect, in the next decades will be that people will devise these, what will effectively be gene therapy vectors that will bring about a direct reprogramming, the direct generation of missing brain cells in your own head. So that's one possibility. A second possibility, and again, I'm pretty enthusiastic about this, is I mentioned earlier the bystander effect. So I mentioned that when you engraft stem cells into the damaged brain, they seem able to recruit the brain to help mend itself. So rather than the stem cells replacing brain tissue, they sort of encourage the host brain, the damaged brain, to repair itself. Now that's intriguing, and it begs the question then, well, what is it the stem cells are producing? What are they secreting? What are they doing that's encouraging the brain to behave in that way, that's encouraging that endogenous repair? And progress is being made on that. We now think we understand some of the factors that are being released by the stem cells that are bringing about this effect. If that works out, then instead of injecting stem cells, we can perhaps produce a therapeutic that isn't actually a stem cell. It's more in a sense like a sort of conventional vaccine or a conventional biological that would itself bring about the repair effect. And so that's an avenue of research that's also being pursued really quite avidly. In the context, we started off, didn't we, talking about COVID and the situation we're currently in. You'll be aware that at least one of the Pfizer vaccine that's currently being used is basically an RNA, encapsulated RNA messenger RNA structure that brings about, that acts as a vaccine. Well, one can imagine a situation where you actually introduced an RNA, okay, that would go into in a form like that would go into a cell, to a brain cell, and get the brain cell to produce a protein another factor of some kind that would elicit this kind of repair that would talk the brain cells into repairing themselves. So that's not there yet. So, you know, you're going to have to wait a little while for that. But it seems to me quite plausible that's a technology that could work into the future.
Interesting. And do either of these approaches incorporate enhancing neurogenesis in a brain?
Yeah, that's another approach. So that's not specifically, that's not a cell therapy, but you're quite right. I mean, there's a lot of work being done, as you'll be aware, on encouraging neurogenesis within the hippocampus. So we probably should explain to our listeners that the hippocampus is possibly the only area in the human brain. Other vertebrates have other areas, but the human brain possibly only has one area where there are true endogenous stem cells. So stem cells that are actually, in a normal adult, are actually generating brain cells, a continuous process. And we know that those cells in the hippocampus are really, really important for mood and for memory. So there's quite a lot of evidence that in chronically depressed individuals, and also, as we mentioned earlier, in sufferers of dementia, Alzheimer's patients, there is a loss of that neurogenesis, so that those endogenous stem cells simply stop or reduce the number of nerve cells they make. And actually, we know that happens just with aging anyway. As you get older, that neurogenesis tends to fall away. So if we could come up with a therapy that would encourage that endogenous stem cell neurogenesis, that would also be a potential therapeutic. And there's been quite a lot of research by different drug companies trying to come with different therapeutics that could encourage that effect.
Excellent. I think I will subscribe to one of these alternative futures.
I know. I mean, one of the scary things about cell therapy is what you have to go through to have it. So you get wheeled into an operating theatre. You get a hole drilled in your head, and somebody shoves a needle in and squirts in stem cells. It's it works, but it's not to say it isn't fractionally scary. Actually, just to say, if I may, one of the other things you're asking me how things are going to develop, technologies are going to develop in the future. One thing that's already happening is that the delivery of stem cells, the delivery of cell therapies, is becoming much more sophisticated. So we were talking very briefly, weren't we, about macular degeneration. And there I said that it's these retinal pigment epithelial cells which get injected, and they have to be put behind the retina in the eye, which is where the pathology lies, and replace the missing retinal pigment epithelial. But the best examples of that now, rather than the surgeon just injecting a sort of slurry of stem cells into this virtual space, what they now do and what technologists have developed is a patch. So what they actually inject isn't just cells. It's a patch. It's a piece of artificial membrane on which the retinal pigment epithelial cells, these important retinal cells, have been grown as a very specific layer. So it's sort of like sticking this patch in behind the damaged retina, and where it sort of immediately lies as an intact structure rather than just cells swimming around. And it's quite clear that has a much improved therapeutic effect. And I suspect this is another development that's going to increase in the future, that the way we've done it in the past, where, as I say, you just inject a sort of an aqueous slurry of cells. Could you imagine a more primitive way of introducing cellular material into something as complex and as delicate as the brain than just, you know, squirting cells in a aqueous suspension?
Yeah, perhaps all of these legacy technologies, they're going to serve their time and then manage.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. We can do better. We will do better.
Excellent. So that's a really fascinating topic. And just so much to be hopeful about for the future. Okay, so we've taken a lot of your time today. So I would like to ask, what are you currently working on?
Well, I'm working on another book. My other big interest in recent years has been autism, and particularly in the context of neurotypical versus alternative behaviours. Just to go backwards, the reason why I wrote the book we've been discussing about brain repair was I was very conscious that there's a huge amount of hype around stem cells and the potential for brain repair. My sense is that too many people believe the hype and believe the nonsense because they don't really understand the biology. And the biology can be immensely challenging, but at the same time, in some ways, it can be quite simple. Some of the concepts are really not that difficult. And I wrote the book we've been discussing in an attempt to try and explain, you know, why the brain doesn't repair itself, why it needs help, what kind of helps might work, and how we might go about delivering them. So autism and the divergence of sort of autistic individuals with autism from what we might call neurotypicality is another process that we're starting to understand the biology of. So it's a neurodevelopmental disorder. Something happens in utero that diverts that baby into a different trajectory. And we've certainly not cracked it by any means. We're by no means fully understanding what's going on. But we've got really quite a grasp of some of the elements of it. And so I'm currently working on a book trying to explain the neurodevelopmental aspects of autism. And I hope people will find that of interest also.
Oh, for sure. That's amazing. I'm really hoping you're going to come here to talk about it.
Yeah, well, I'd love to. I've got to finish it first, but I would love to talk to you about it in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. So where can our listeners find more information about the book and also your work?
If you go to my book's published by MIT Press, and the MIT Press website, you'll find it on there. You can buy it for any good booksellers. So you'd find it at Waterstones, you'll find it at Amazon. It's available. If you Google me, you'll find me and my website, and I talk a bit more on my King's College London website about other things I do. I also have a blog. I have a blog on the Psychology Today webpage. And in fact, I posted a blog just on Friday. So again, you'll find more information on some of the things we've talked about today, and quite a lot about the autism that I'm working on currently. You'll find quite a lot and on that blog site. So those are places people can go if they want to know a little bit more.
Excellent. Okay, so thank you so much for coming here today. I learned a lot, and I'm sure that our listeners are going to find your book completely exhilarating, to be honest.
Well, I hope so, and thank you very much for the invitation. I've really enjoyed it. It's been fun talking.
Okay, take care.
Yeah, you too.